TED Audio Collective.
I'm Elise Hugh. You're listening to TED Talks Daily. Essayist and travel writer Pico Iyer speaks so movingly about how to find home and a sense of belonging in places across the globe. It was the central idea of his 2013 archive TED Talk, which we're sharing with you today. After the talk, he sits down with me to dig a little deeper into how travel has shaped his idea of home. He also picked a book for our summer book club series. It's a collection of essays called Letter to a Stranger, Essays to the Ones Who Haunt Us, edited by Colleen Kinder. Okay, enjoy.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Where do you come from? It's such a simple question, but these days, of course, simple questions bring ever more complicated answers. People are always asking me where I come from, and they're expecting me to say India, and they're absolutely right insofar as 100% of my blood and ancestry does come from India, except I've never lived one day of my life there. I can't speak even one word of its more than 22,000 dialects, so I don't think I've really earned the right to call myself an Indian. And if where do you come from means where were you born and raised and educated, then I'm entirely of that funny little country known as England. Except I left England as soon as I completed my undergraduate education, and all the time I was growing up, I was the only kid in all my classes who didn't begin to look like the classic English heroes represented in our textbooks. And if where do you come from means where do you pay your taxes, where do you see your doctor and your dentist, then I'm very much of the United States, and I have been for 48 years now, since I was a really small child, except for many of those years I've had to carry around this funny little pink card with green lines running through my face, identifying me as a permanent alien. And I do actually feel more alien the longer I live there. And if where do you come from means which place goes deepest inside you, and where do you try to spend most of your time, then I'm Japanese, because I've been living as much as I can for the last 25 years in Japan, except all of those years I've been there on a tourist visa, and I'm fairly sure not many Japanese would want to consider me one of them. And I say all this just to stress how very old-fashioned and straightforward my background is, because when I go to Hong Kong or Sydney or Vancouver, most of the kids I meet are much more international and multicultural than I am. And they have one home associated with their parents, but another associated with their partners, a third connected maybe with the place where they happen to be, a fourth connected with the place they dream of being, and many more besides. And their whole life will be spent taking pieces of many different places and putting them together into a stained glass whole. Home for them is really a work in progress. It's like a project on which they're constantly adding upgrades and improvements and corrections. And for more and more of us, home has really less to do with a piece of soil than, you could say, with a piece of soul. If somebody suddenly asks me, "Where's your home?" I think about my sweetheart or my closest friends or the songs that travel with me wherever I happen to be. And I'd always felt this way, but it really came home to me, as it were, some years ago when I was climbing up the stairs in my parents' house in California. And I looked through the living room windows, and I saw that we were encircled by 70-foot flames, one of those wildfires that regularly tear through the hills of California and many other such places. And 3 hours later, that fire had reduced my home and every last thing in it, except for me, to ash. And when I woke up the next morning, I was sleeping on a friend's floor. The only thing I had in the world was a toothbrush I'd just bought from an all-night supermarket. Of course, if anybody asked me then, "Where is your home?" I literally couldn't point to any physical construction. My home would have to be whatever I carried around inside me. And in so many ways, I think this is a terrific liberation. Because when my grandparents were born, they pretty much had their sense of home, their sense of community, even their sense of enmity assigned to them at birth, and didn't have much chance of stepping outside of that. And nowadays, at least some of us can choose our sense of home, create our sense of community, fashion our sense of self, and in so doing, maybe step a little beyond some of the black and white divisions of our grandparents' age. And I've always felt that the beauty of being surrounded by the foreign is that it slaps you awake. You can't take anything for granted. Travel, for me, is a little bit like being in love, because suddenly all your senses are at the setting marked on. Suddenly you're alert to the secret patterns of the world. The real voyage of discovery, as Marcel Proust famously said, consists not in seeing new sights, but in looking with new eyes. And of course, once you have new eyes, even the old sights, even your home, become something different. Many of the people living in countries not their own are refugees who never wanted to leave home and ache to go back home. But for the fortunate among us, I think the age of movement brings exhilarating new possibilities. Certainly when I'm traveling, especially to the major cities of the world, the typical person I meet today will be, let's say, a half Korean, half German young woman living in Paris. And as soon as she meets a half Thai, half Canadian young guy from Edinburgh, she recognizes him as kin. She realizes that she probably has much more in common with him than with anybody entirely of Korea or entirely of Germany. So they become friends. They fall in love. They move to New York City. And or Edinburgh. And the little girl who arises out of their union will, of course, be not Korean or German or French or Thai or Scotch or Canadian or even American, but a wonderful and constantly evolving mix of all those places. And potentially, everything about the way that young woman dreams about the world, writes about the world, thinks about the world, could be something different, because it comes out of this almost unprecedented blend of cultures. Where you come from now is much less important than where you're going. More and more of us are rooted in the future or the present tense as much as in the past. And home, we know, is not just the place where you happen to be born. It's the place where you become yourself. And yet, there is one great problem with movement, and that is that it's really hard to get your bearings when you're in midair. Some years ago, I noticed that I had accumulated 1 million miles on United Airlines alone. You all know that crazy system. 6 days in hell, you get the seventh day free. And and I began to think that really movement was only as good as the sense of stillness that you could bring to it to put it into perspective. And 8 months after my house burnt down, I ran into a friend who taught at a local high school. And he said, "I've got the perfect place for you." "Really?" I said. And I'm always a bit skeptical when people say things like that. "No, honestly," he went on, it's only 3 hours away by car, and it's not very expensive, and it's probably not like anywhere you've stayed before." I was beginning to get slightly intrigued. What is it? "Well," here my friend hemmed and hawed, "well, actually, it's a Catholic hermitage." This was the wrong answer. I had spent 15 years in Anglican school, so I had had enough hymnals and crosses to last me a lifetime. Several lifetimes, actually. But my friend assured me that he wasn't Catholic, nor were most of his students, but he took his classes there every spring. And as he had it, even the most restless, distractible, testosterone-addled 15-year-old Californian boy only had to spend 3 days in silence, and something in him cooled down and cleared out. He found himself. And I thought, anything that works for a 15-year-old boy ought to work for me. So I got in my car, and I drove 3 hours north along the coast, and the roads grew emptier and narrower. And then I turned onto an even narrower path, barely paved, that snaked for 2 miles up to the top of a mountain. And when I got out of my car, the air was pulsing. The whole place was absolutely silent, but the silence wasn't an absence of noise. It was really a presence of a kind of energy or quickening. And at my feet was the great still blue plate of the Pacific Ocean. All around me were 800 acres of wild, dry brush. And I went down to the room in which I was to be sleeping, small but eminently comfortable. It had a bed and a rocking chair and a long desk and even longer picture windows looking out on a small, private, walled garden and then 1,200 feet of golden pampas grass running down to the sea. And I sat down and I began to write and write and write, even though I'd gone there really to get away from my desk. And by the time I got up, 4 hours had passed. Night had fallen. And I went out under this great overturned salt shaker of stars, and I could see the taillights of cars disappearing around the headlands 12 miles to the south. And it really seemed like my concerns of the previous day vanishing. And the next day, when I woke up, in the absence of telephones and TVs and laptops, the day seemed to stretch for 1,000 hours. It was really all the freedom I know when I'm traveling, but it also profoundly felt like coming home. And I'm not a religious person, so I didn't go to the services. I didn't consult the monks for guidance. I just took walks along the monastery road and sent postcards to loved ones. I looked at the clouds, and I did what is hardest of all for me to do usually, which is nothing at all. And I started to go back to this place, and I noticed that I was doing my most important work there, invisibly, just by sitting still. And certainly coming to my most critical decisions the way I never could when I was racing from the last email to the next appointment. And I began to think that something in me had really been crying out for stillness, but of course I couldn't hear it because I was running around so much. I was like some crazy guy who puts on a blindfold and then complains that he can't see a thing. And I thought back to that wonderful phrase I had learned as a boy from Seneca, in which he says, "That man is poor, not who has little, but who hankers after more." And, of course, I'm not suggesting that anybody here go to a monastery. That's not the point. But I do think it's only by stopping movement that you can see where to go. And it's only by stepping out of your life and the world that you can see what you most deeply care about and find a home. And I've noticed so many people now take conscious measures to sit quietly for 30 minutes every morning, just collecting themselves in one corner of the room without their devices, or go running every evening, or leave their cell phones behind when they go to have a long conversation with a friend. Movement is a fantastic privilege, and it allows us to do so much that our grandparents could never have dreamed of doing. But movement, ultimately, only has a meaning if you have a home to go back to. And home, in the end, is, of course, not just the place where you sleep. It's the place where you stand. Thank you.
Hey, y'all, it's Elise Hugh, and I'm here with Pico Iyer. Pico, welcome.
Thank you, Elise. I'm so happy to be here.
We just listened to your TED Talk about the concept of home and belonging, which really resonates with me. You gave that talk back in 2013. So I'm curious, how has your idea of home changed maybe since back then?
I think all of us are just gathering more homes with every passing season as we go to new places or meet new friends or switch to new settings for our jobs. So I think there's nothing I would change from my talk back in 2013 now, except just to underscore the fact that home is a work in progress. It's a sentence that never gets completed. It's just this wonderful collage that we keep expanding upon.
And something you're so known for is your travel writing, among many other things. How has traveling influenced the way you think about the concept of home?
I think it's made my sense of home much more fluid, much less fixed than it would be otherwise. Because at an early age, well, you know, as you know probably, and as I say in my talk, I was born in England to parents from India and moved to California when I was 7. So instantly I had 3 homes. But even traveling casually, I would go to places and they would resonate so deeply inside me. I would think, I belong here. And everybody listening to this conversation has had that experience. You go to somewhere where you have no official connection, but you feel a really heartfelt affiliation. And as my traveling life has continued, and I remember first when I went to Japan, and then later I spent time in Thailand, and then I went to Cuba, which became a big part of my life for many years. And in each case, I felt these are like great friends who are playing an important part in my destiny. And to that extent, they are my homes. At the end of my life, when I think back on all the places that have made me, Cuba and Thailand will feature, as well as England and California and India. And I think home is not just the place where you were born or where you happen to live. It's the place where you become yourself. And that happens in so many different locations for us in a fortunate global world.
Your pick for our summer book club is a collection of essays inspired by travel. It's called Letter to a Stranger, and it's edited by Colleen Kinder. Can you tell us a little about the book?
I can. It's a collection of 65 pieces, very short, by travelers, many of them female. And they're all in the form of letters to people met along the road. Maybe somebody you briefly fell in love with, maybe somebody who took advantage of you, maybe somebody you just couldn't figure out. And the subtitle of the book is Essays to the Ones Who Haunt Us. And I really love that, because I think when any of us comes back from a trip, we bring back photos and key rings and postcards or whatever. But the most important thing we bring home is something that we can never resolve, some person or some moment that keeps reverberating inside us and haunts us maybe for the rest of our lives. And so this is really a collection of letters written to people who will never read these letters, but who have in some indefinable way changed your life.
And I heard that you play a part in sparking the idea for these letters.
Well, I do. You're absolutely right. I was visiting a class taught by the editor, who's an old friend of mine, Colleen Kinder, and it was a class on writing about travel. And she had her students read an old article I'd written for a magazine about Iceland. And when I talked to Colleen in the class, I said, you know, one of the dirty secrets of travel writing is that when you receive an assignment from a magazine, you describe the beautiful hotels and the cool restaurants and the dazzling sights you saw. But really, there's no space for writing about the thing that really affected you deep down. So in Iceland, I wrote about traveling around this magical place in the middle of summer when the sun never sets and you don't know when to eat or when to sleep, and all the festivals that were filling the streets and the strange geological features of the island. But really, what stayed with me was a young woman I met, and I became very close to her, though it was completely platonic. We walked around the streets together night after dove gray night, and that was really, for me, the beautiful memory I took back from Iceland. There was no place for that young lady in the piece I wrote for the magazine, but in pieces I wrote for myself or in subsequent books, that was really the strongest memory. And so I think that quickened Colleen into thinking about, first, the unwritten stories from our trips, and secondly, how often they involve another person who maybe we'll never see again. And I love the fact that all the pieces in this book are written in the second person. They're all written to you. And, you know, I've been writing travel literature for 40 years. I've been reading it for even longer. And I remember when I was growing up, it was nearly always written by guys from the colonial countries, you know, maybe Brits traveling around
typically,
Kenya,
yes,
and India and talking about the strange ways of the natives. And now I think it's written more and more by young women from every part of the world, writing maybe about England, America, and the strange things they find there. And the you form suddenly makes it much more intimate and implicates you. And it reminds you that the center of the story is not really you, but it's perhaps somebody else whose life is much richer and more mysterious than your own.
65 extraordinary writers contributed, including Lauren Groff, Maggie Shipstead, Elizabeth Colbert, and you, Pico Iyer. Who is your stranger?
Yes, and actually my piece is an expansion of another TED Talk I gave once on the beauty of what we don't know. And in that piece, I described how 37 years ago, I arrived in the old Burmese city of Mandalay, and a bicycle rickshaw man invited me to come and see the city with him, and we got into darker and more deserted streets, and I really wondered what was going on. And I finally realized he was taking me to his home so he could show me all the letters that he'd written to foreigners and his dreams, the essays he'd written in English about how he wanted to be a teacher of mathematics. And I hadn't known whether to trust this person because he was a complete stranger. And by the end of the day, I realized he was a friend. But I've only met that man once, 37 years ago. But we started corresponding, and he would send me letters, which were probably very difficult and expensive for him to send in a closed country like Burma, and I would keep up with him. And so there was a sense in which I think more about this man whom I met for one afternoon 37 years ago than I think about some of my oldest friends or the people I grow up with. And I think that's part of the beauty of travel. It rearranges your priorities and proportions, and somebody you only encounter fleetingly may stay with you forever.
Lovely. The book is called Letter to a Stranger, Essays to the Ones Who Haunt Us, edited by Colleen Kinder. And the TED Talk you just heard was from Pico Iyer. Pico, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Really a pleasure to talk to you. PRX.